From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Harmonica virtuoso Larry Adler started his career in vaudeville, played with George Gershwin and Duke Ellington, then went on to the concert hall, accompanying the world's major symphonies. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the versatile Larry Adler, and he plays us a few tunes. Tony Hillerman writes mystery novels about a Navajo police lieutenant. Coming up, Hillerman explains how he, a white Roman Catholic, got so absorbed in Navajo culture. Rockcritic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the husband and wife team of Cecil and Linda Womack. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A World Apart, starring Barbara Hershey. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Larry Adler, the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He began his musical career in vaudeville in 1928. He went on to play with musicians and performers like George Gershwin, Fred Astaire, Jack Benny, and Duke Ellington. But Adler is also at home in the concert hall performing music by Bach, Beethoven, and Liszt with the world's major symphonies. He's had works written for him by Ralph Vaughan Williams and Darius Milhaud. It's been said of Adler's musicianship that what he can't do on the harmonica can't be done. And Adler has said of his own work that he would like his epitaph to repeat what Billie Holiday once said to him, "You don't play that thing, you sing it." Larry Adler grew up in Baltimore in an Orthodox Russian-Jewish family. He now lives in London, where he moved in the early 50s after being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. Larry Adler has written an autobiography. It's titled It Ain't Necessarily So. Larry Adler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm very ashamed of you. I may as well start off telling you right
now. What did I do?
Oh, you cleaned up the Billie Holiday story.
No, I know. I took out the expletive.
Yeah, you know, why can't we tell it this way? She heard me play with Duke Ellington, and then Duke took me over, and he said, "Larry, this is Billie Holiday." And I put out my hand to say, "How do you do?" And she says, "Man, you don't play that bleeping thing. You sing it." Now, you see, you can get it that way.
Okay, well, thanks. You shame me. Well, you have brought your harmonica with you. And before we talk about your life, I'd love for you to maybe play a pop song for us, and maybe I'll ask you to do some
classical
music. All
right, I'll tell you what. You name the song, and I'll play it. Anything you like.
How about something by Rodgers and Hart or Gershwin? Give you your choice.
Do you know what chorus I'm about to go into?
No, is that the verse?
That's the verse.
Oh, and I was trying to figure out why I didn't recognize it.
All right, here comes the chorus.
Okay.
Thank you.
great. My Funny Valentine.
Now, see, nobody knows the verse. So nobody knows that that verse leads into that chorus.
That's great.
I don't think anybody knows the verse of anything.
You know, your tone is so different than the kind of tone that blues players have.
Mm-hmm.
You really have a different kind of vibrato.
Oh, yes, quite.
It's a completely different kind of tone.
Well, you must remember, my tone is the sum total, probably, of every musician I ever admired. Jascha Heifetz, Dizzy Gillespie, Duke Ellington, Andre Segovia, Django Reinhardt, Louis Armstrong, all of them, Bill Evans, all of them shape my playing, because the minute I admire a musician, something rubs off.
The way you tell it in your autobiography, you ran away from home when you were 14 in
yes.
the hopes of joining Borominovich and his harmonica band. And I think it's a pretty brave thing to run away when you're 14. But why did you have to run away to do it?
Well, I certainly couldn't have gotten permission from my mother and father. They wouldn't let me at the age of 14 go to New York. And I wanted to get away. And I had won this mouth organ competition. I was Baltimore's mouth organ champion. I read in the paper, Lawrence Cecil Adler, this is the man you're talking to, is the champion of Baltimore, and boy, I believed it. Went right to my head, and I was stage struck. I'd seen Al Jolson, I'd seen Eddie Cantor, I'd also heard Rachmaninoff, I'd seen Otto Klemperer conduct. I wanted to do what they did, and the best way was to get on the stage somehow. Now, I had about $50 my parents didn't know about because I sold Liberty magazines. So simply, without telling them, I went down to Union Station in Baltimore, got on a train. I had met a musician named Nat Brusiloff who'd made the great mistake of saying to me, if you ever come to New York, kid, look me up. He didn't know, because I looked him up. And the poor man had to take care of me.
Well, you never made it into the Borominovich band.
Well, that was thanks to Borominovich, because I auditioned for him, and I played my guts out, because this, to me, this was the epitome. This was God. And I played the Beethoven Minuet in G, which was the piece that I'd used to win the Baltimore Mouth Organ Competition. And when I finished playing, Mr. Minovich said, kid, you stink. I started to cry. I still can't imagine the savagery of talking to a young kid like that. And Bora had a dwarf in his band named Johnny Paleo. And Johnny said, Bora, why don't you let the kid come on with us for one show? And Minovich says, get him out of here. He stinks. Now, how does one go on from there? That is the thing that
baffled
me.
Well, how did you go on after that?
Well, I got on a streetcar. They had streetcars in those days. And I was going down to Penn Station, and I intended to go back to Baltimore because if Minovich didn't want me, what future was there? When the streetcar got to the Paramount Theater on Broadway, there was Rudy Valli's name in lights, and I remembered hearing him on the radio. And on impulse, I got off the streetcar, sneaked past the doorman, played to Valli, who put me on that night at his nightclub, where I flopped. It didn't mean a thing, but Valli had noticed me. He didn't say, kid, you stink. So on the strength of that minute encouragement, I stayed on. And within a week, I had a job on the Paramount circuit, including, by the way, playing in Philadelphia. And I played 44 weeks, doing 4, 5, and 6 shows a day. And that's how I began.
You were in vaudeville for quite a while.
Yes.
What was your act like, and what were some of the roles you had to take on in the act?
Well, it's a bit embarrassing, because when I first had this contract with Paramount and I tried to do an act, well, I didn't have an act. I didn't know how to do an act. And it was the comedian in the show, it was a traveling road show, he thought of the idea of making me a local boy. So in 44 cities, I was a local boy. I was a local boy in Philadelphia. I was a local boy in Chicago and Denver. And I used to get the most applause of anyone on the bill because this is our local boy. Give him a big hand. So the other act hated my guts, but there I was, local boy, making good. One thing that does puzzle me, in those days we did not use microphones and there were stage bands. How in hell could they hear me? A mouth organ has very little projection power. And yet when I finished playing, they applauded. So do you suppose, and this is one theory, did they listen better in those days? Without the amplification, they would have to listen to hear the sound, and maybe that is the explanation.
Maybe that's it. You were exposed to a lot of sex when you were pretty young.
Oh, still?
You
don't think I've given it up, do you?
No, but I'm thinking this 14 and 15-year-old in the middle of vaudeville, and people would take you to sex shows.
Only one, really. When we got to New Orleans, there was a big sexual exhibition, and the people on my bill and the people at the RKO Theater, we chipped in, and hired what was called a circus. And because I was only 14 or 15 years old, they didn't make me pay. That was my first freebie, a sexual circus. And I sat there and I watched these incredible things going on that I didn't know existed. And it, I think, in a way, it almost put me off sex.
Oh, really? Because yeah. It was so crass.
It was scary. It wasn't pleasurable at all. And also, I, even as a kid, I think I was aware of people being exploited. I didn't like it. I've never liked striptease dancers, for example. I feel that they're being used and exploited. I didn't like that sex show. I don't like strippers. I don't like anything where people are made use of and they're not individuals anymore.
Well, did you feel exploited in vaudeville?
No, I wasn't exploited in my act.
Mm-hmm. What did you do? What kind of music did you play in the act?
I did Button Up Your Overcoat and an impression of Helen Kane singing I Want to Be Loved by You. That was my act, just those two numbers. Then later on, I got rid of the Helen Kane number and I played When Day Is Done. And you and I were talking before about this new record that's come out, Larry Adler Live at the Ballroom. I suggested they call it Larry Adler Dead in the Bathroom. I think it would be just as good a title. But on that record, I play When Day Is Done exactly as I played it when I was 14. And when I listened to it, I thought, hey, Adler, you really haven't improved a bit.
How did you break into pop music, an American popular song, playing Rodgers and Hart, meeting the Gershwins?
Well, mind you, look who was around in those days. Yeah. Not only Rodgers and Hart, Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen. These people were like Schubert and Mendelssohn. They just wrote wonderful things, and you wanted to play them. Now, I was in Gus Edwards' act. It was a kiddie act. And while I was with him at the Palace, Paul Whiteman was playing at the Roxy with his own film, The King of Jazz. And I was dying to have Whiteman listen to me. So between my shows, I would go up to the Roxy and stand outside the stage door, and whoever came in or out, I'd blow the mouth organ in their face, hoping someone would say, what a talented little boy this is. Well, finally someone did. Frankie Trumbauer, the very, very famous saxophone player, took me into Whiteman's dressing room. He says, Paul, listen to this kid. So I played Poet and Peasant. And when I finished playing it, Whiteman said, let me hear you play the Rhapsody in Blue. I was 15. I couldn't handle the Rhapsody in Blue. But I was a very arrogant, snotty little kid, and success has not changed me. I couldn't let him know that I didn't know Rhapsody in Blue and that it was too tough for me. So I said, I don't like Rhapsody in Blue. So he turns to a young man I hadn't noticed before, and he said, how do you like that, George? And that's how I met Gershwin.
Were you friends after that?
Well, that was the end of that, because right. I got out fast. But right. However, about 3 years later, a man named Jules Glenzer, who was the vice president of Cartier, he gave me a farewell party. I was going to England for the first time. This was 1934. And at this party, there was Johnny Green, there was Harold Arlen, there was Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, and with them all, I played a song of theirs. Now, I knew that sooner or later I was going to play something with George, and then our host, Jules Glenzer, said, Larry and George are going to play the Rhapsody in Blue. Well, by now, I'd heard it so many times, it was in my head, and I've got a very good ear. If it's in my head, I can play it. So George sat at the piano, I started to play, and when we finished playing, George got up and he put his hand on my shoulder and he says, the goddamn thing sounds as if I wrote it for you. Now, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because to me, the goddamn thing still does sound that way. And in my act now, I have a piano roll made by George Gershwin. That is on that record also. And I've put scotch tape over the melody line. It sounds literally as if Gershwin is accompanying me. It's wonderful, and it's an eerie feeling.
You toured with Jack Benny for
yes.
a long time. Did you ever play music comedy with him? We all remember his attempts at being a violin virtuoso.
Well, we would do a duet together, and Jack would hit one note like this, then me on the mouth organ. Jack. Jack. All that one note. And it was very funny. And I probably learned as much from Jack Benny as one could learn from any individual performer because, first of all, he was an encyclopedia. And he gave me advice once in two words, which is the most valuable lesson I think you could ever learn in show business. And the two words are, don't press. And boy, that is a hard lesson to learn, because if you're playing for an audience that doesn't like you, the impulse is work harder, win them over. He says do just the opposite, relax, wait for them to find you.
Huh.
Oh, it takes you a long time to learn that.
We had some of the best timing in all of show business.
There is nothing like Jack's timing.
And one of the subtlest performers.
Yes. And also, he was one of the most considerate of people. See, I did 3 overseas tours with Jack Benny during World War II. And he encouraged me to do comedy. And if I got a bigger laugh than Jack, to him that just made the show better. There's many a comedian I know who, if you got a bigger laugh than they, you were out. You were fired. That was not Jack's way.
My guest is Larry Adler, harmonica virtuoso, and author of a new autobiography titled It Ain't Necessarily So. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Larry Adler is my guest. He's the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He's performed with Fred Astaire, George Gershwin, Jack Benny, as well as with symphonies around the world. He moved to England after being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. He's written an autobiography. It's titled It Ain't Necessarily So. We should talk about your classical music playing. We've talked a little bit about vaudeville and pop. Very, very few people have played classical music on the harmonica. Why did you drift toward that?
I was always inclined toward the classical because the first musical impression I think I ever had was Sergei Rachmaninoff. An uncle took me to a recital of his at the Lyric Theater in Baltimore. And I believe that I can still remember the impression that that magnificent musician made on this little kid, 5 years old. And when I first played with the Baltimore Symphony, in the same building where I heard Rachmaninoff, I remember walking around the hall seeing if I could remember where I was sitting to hear Rachmaninoff. But once having heard Rachmaninoff, I wanted to play classical music. And then I heard Yasha Heifetz, I heard Pablo Casals. Well, of course I wanted to do what they did. This was great music I was listening to. And it didn't occur to me to consider whether or not the instrument was right for it. If I wanted to do it, that was my medium. And I thought that I would be able to express myself on it, and I think I do.
It must have been hard getting accepted.
Oh, I don't think I'm accepted yet. I commissioned a work from Khachaturian, and he said to me, I'll go back to Russia, I will tell people about you, and they will not believe me. I said, well, why shouldn't they believe you? He said, because in Russia, small boys play their garmushka on street corners, and no one will believe that you can play classical music on the mouth organ. And that is still the general feeling. I mean, people, friends of mine, I've known them for years. Let's say they haven't heard me for 3 or 4 years. They hear me. Larry, it's amazing what you get out of that little thing. Well, that's the big cliche. I've been getting music out of that little thing for 59 professional years.
Can I ask you to play some classical music for us now?
You can ask me. Maybe I won't answer you.
What? Well, let's try.
What would you like?
Something by Bach?
By Bach, sure. Thank you.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Several composers have written works for you.
Yes.
And I'm sure those were composers who had never written for your instrument. What did you have to tell them about how to play harmonica and what a harmonica can or can't do?
I would lay out a diagram showing the limitations and capability. Like, for example, Vaughan Williams, I gave him a diagram showing which intervals, which chords were possible, which ones you couldn't play. And Vaughan Williams told me he pasted my instructions on his shaving mirror. And while he shaved, he would study what to write and what not to write. When the work was finished, there were a few things he'd written that were unplayable. For example, he had me playing C and F together. And you can't do that because you exhale C and you inhale F. And even with my two heads, I've never been able to figure out a way to do that. So I went down to Dorking, where he lived, after I'd received the manuscript. And I said, Mr. Vaughan Williams, please forgive me, but there are certain things in the work that do not lie naturally for the mouth organ. And he interrupted me. He says, so you don't like what I wrote, eh? Well, I wasn't saying that at all. But of course, I know now he was doing this for effect. He was, in his way, he was like Jack Benny. He says, well, if you don't like the way I wrote it, and he paused in that timing, and he says, I'll change it. And if you like it the second time, I'll revise it once more. But if you don't like it the third time, I'm going to rescore the whole bloody thing for bass tuba.
Would it be imposing to ask you to play a line or two that one of the composers wrote for you?
Well, here's the beginning of the Vaughan Williams. Now, he used the chord possibility of the mouth organ better than almost any other composer. And here's the beginning of the Vaughan Williams Romance for mouth organ, piano, and strings. You see how he uses the chord possibilities.
Yeah.
Now, against that, he has a steady B double flat, and it just sounds wonderful to hear the bass note of the B double flat and those chords you just heard me play.
When you play with an orchestra, the orchestra has to tune to you. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the only man who ever gave me a hard time was your own ex-conductor of the Philadelphia Symphony, Eugene Ormandy. There was the Ford Symphony Hour, and Mr. Ormandy was the conductor, and I was going to be the soloist playing the Vivaldi A minor concerto, the Vivaldi violin concerto. And I heard later he did not want to conduct for me at all, and he tried to get me canceled. But we each had a contract. Mine was as valid as his. Now, he rehearsed the orchestra and didn't let me come out until the last 10 minutes of rehearsal time, which was really awful. So I came out, and I gave my aid to the violinist, and Ormandy says, what is this? I said, well, you see, they have to tune to me. The mouth organ is the fixed reed. I cannot tune to them. He said, this is ridiculous. And I've never talked back to a conductor. I'm a coward anyway. But I said to him, Mr. Ormandy, I have played this work with this orchestra last year. If it embarrasses you to conduct it, I think we could do it without you.
Oh, I'm sure you got a great response to
that. Oh, the orchestra loved it.
Oh, dear. So what happened?
Well, he conducted it perfectly well for me, but he didn't talk to me after the concert.
I'm sure. Geez, you know, I would have liked to see you when you were 10 years old and you were a cantor.
Oh, I was so cute. You would have loved me. I was the most adorable little schmuck you have ever seen in your life.
Well, you were a 10-year-old, and for any listeners who don't know what a cantor is, the cantor is the person who conducts the singing part of the religious ceremony in a Jewish temple. Well, and I'm wondering if you did that when you were 10 for reasons of show business or religion.
No. What had happened was I was in a choir in Baltimore, and at the end of the high holidays, they gave each choir boy a gold watch, which I found very unsatisfactory. There was a choir on the synagogue across Druid Hill Park where they paid money. So I went over there and auditioned for them and got in their choir. Religion had nothing to do with it. Now, the cantor, his name was Adolf Weissgall, decided to create a children's synagogue and had me as the cantor. And I must admit that during my term as cantor, I was so religious. But then, during my term as cantor, I became 13. I was bar mitzvah, which meant I was a man, and I lost my job as cantor, and the religion began to fall away as of that moment.
There's no money or fame in it anymore.
I lost my power base.
Could you have played, do you think, a conventional instrument?
Well, I studied the piano, and I studied at the Peabody Conservatory, and I have a unique distinction, the sole student ever to have been expelled from Peabody. I had prepared a waltz by Grieg, and when I came up on the stage to play it, the principal of the school said, "And what are we going to play, my little man?" So I went to the piano and I played, "Yes, We Have No Bananas." And my parents got a letter, "Don't send him back." But I was fascinated by the piano. I would love to have been a concert pianist, but equally I know I would never have had the discipline that it requires to practice 6 to 8 hours a day to become a concert pianist. I'm a very good drawing room pianist, very good indeed, and my harmonies are good, my interpretation is fine, but I would never have become a concert pianist.
It takes discipline for the harmonica.
No, not as much, because, you see, there was no precedent. There was no Yasha Heifetz. Nobody could say, "Make like Rachmaninoff." There was no Rachmaninoff of the mouth organ. If there was, I was it.
I see what you mean. You returned to performing in the States. I think it was in the mid-70s, after you left the United States because you were blacklisted. You couldn't get any jobs here. Did it take till the mid-70s until it was okay for you to perform here?
Not quite as bad as that. I came back in 1959, and I played at the Village Gate, a nightclub in New York. And I played a few others, such as the Hungry Eye in San Francisco and Mr. Kelly's in Chicago. But it didn't really catch on. These engagements were okay individually, but it didn't create a demand for me. Then I came back again in the 60s to do a film score in Hollywood, and Isaac Stern had introduced me to Saul Hurock, who said he would try to book a tour for me, and he could only get 3 concerts in about 6 months, and he said, "Larry, you've got to face facts. Concert committees are run by Republican ladies with long memories."
Right. So you're still living in England, and you're going to stay there?
I still live there. I most certainly am going to stay there. I like it very much. I think England, with all its faults, is the most civilized country I know.
Well, I'm glad you're back to perform, if not to live. And I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed the
interview. Thanks. A pleasure to being here. Larry Adler's autobiography is titled It Ain't Necessarily So. It's published by Grove Press. He's performing this week at the Ballroom in New York City. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with playwright Horton Foote. He won Academy Awards for his screenplays For To Kill a Mockingbird and Tender Mercies. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Robert Robert Redford has purchased the film rights to Tony Hillerman's mystery novels. Hillerman's books are about a Navajo police lieutenant who investigates murders on the reservation. Coming up, a talk with Tony Hillerman. The husband and wife team of Cecil and Linda Womack have a new album. Their music incorporates rock, soul, rhythm and blues, and a little gospel. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A World Apart, starring Barbara Hershey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman. A House subcommittee voted 7-0 this afternoon to recommend the impeachment of U.S. District Judge Alcee Hastings. Hastings has spent much of his 8 years on the bench dealing with charges that he conspired with a Washington attorney to solicit bribes from defendants hoping for lenient treatment. The panel now sends 17 articles of impeachment against Hastings to the full House Judiciary Committee for its consideration. Hastings is the first black federal judge in Florida's history. As more information becomes available on the downing of an Iranian airliner, the Pentagon is amending its version of the incident. NPR's David Malpas reports that officials still blame Iran for placing the plane in harm's way.
Initially, Pentagon officials said the Iranian Airbus was outside the zone designated for civilian planes when it was shot down. But today, officials revised that. It was off the center line of the zone, but still within it. The Pentagon also discounted theories that the misidentification was caused by a second plane. Pentagon spokesman Dan Howard said there's virtually no way the Vincennes, an Aegis cruiser, could have not detected a second plane.
The Aegis system, again, is very sensitive. And unless those two aircraft managed to take off in tandem and stay about 8 feet apart throughout the course of this flight, and managed to get shot out of the air together and fall together, then there were no two aircraft. There's no phantom aircraft there.
Officials today could not explain discrepancies about the plane's altitude. The USS Vincennes, which downed the plane, reported it at 7,000 to 9,000 feet, but another U.S. ship sighted the plane at 12,000 feet. Officials say computer tapes on board the Vincennes may clear up the confusion. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
A pro-Iranian terrorist group said today it will use the American hostages it holds in Lebanon as part of a large-scale retaliation against the United States for downing the Iranian passenger plane. But in Tehran, Iranian President Ali Khamenei suggested his country would avoid terrorism in avenging the incident. A misfired mortar shot during a Marine training exercise in Hawaii has killed 2 Marines and injured 15 others. A platoon was practicing night defense fire last night when the mortar accidentally landed among the group. Navy spokesman Major Kerry Gashanik.
7 of the injured have been released after treatment. The remainder of the injured are being treated at medical facilities at Kona and Hilo on the island of Hawaii, as well as at Tripler Army Medical Center on Oahu. The names of the dead and injured are being withheld pending notification of next of kin.
Marine officials say the accident is being investigated. The Department of Energy set off a large underground nuclear explosion at the Nevada test site today. Teresa Rogers of member station KNPR has details.
This morning's nuclear blast registered 5.6 on the Richter scale. That means it was one of the larger ones conducted at the Nevada test site. People in high-rise buildings in Las Vegas, 100 miles away, reported feeling the effects of the blast as hanging plants and light fixtures swayed. This was the 8th announced nuclear test of the year and the 6th that the government has conducted since that team of Soviet scientists has been stationed near the test site. The Soviets are preparing for next month's joint verification experiments. Meanwhile, electrical workers at the Nevada test site have rejected a new contract proposal for the second time in a month. Union officials won't say if this means they'll call a strike. An Energy Department spokesman says if a strike is called, non-union workers will be pressed into service and that a strike probably would not affect the joint verification experiments. A strike at the test site last fall slowed down but did not stop the nation's underground nuclear testing program. For National Public Radio, I'm Teresa Rogers in Las Vegas.
Stock prices on the New York Exchange closed lower today, down more than 7 points to close at 2122.69. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The roots of the music duo Womack and Womack are the roots of soul music. Linda is the daughter of singer Sam Cooke. Cecil was performing on the gospel circuit at the age of 4 with his brother Bobby and with performers like Marvin Gaye, the Staple Singers, and Sam Cooke. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Womack and Womack's new album, Conscience.
Womack and Womack's Conscience is one of the most pleasurable albums of the year, a collection of songs drenched in the richest, most artful variations on soul, gospel, rock, and rhythm and blues. Cecil and Linda Womack are husband and wife, and many of their songs are about their marriage and how a commitment such as theirs is tested over the course of any enduring relationship. But the Womacks are also married to a tradition of music, committed to a level of pop discourse that used to be regularly addressed in the music of Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, and Gladys Knight. It's a tradition which seems almost forgotten these days. Even when Womack and Womack sing about a relationship gone bad, the intensity of their devotion comes through. This is cool, sexy music that nonetheless conveys a kind of romantic agony. It communicates the intense pain that intense love can inspire. And quite aside from the lyrics and on the most immediate level, Womack and Womack do a marvelous job of updating the soul sound for the late 1980s. They've structured Conscience as a kind of concept album. It's a sustained conversation between two people. Infidelities and breakups are imagined or remembered, worked out or left messy, tangled, and sensitive. The album peaks with what I think is an extraordinary song called Good Man Monologue.
You better stop, think about what you're saying. I was seriously dedicated in a game of playing. You made 1,000 promises you couldn't keep. I forgave you when you lied, pleaded and weeped. Put up with your disrespect and neglect.
That piece of music is a kind of song out of time. It could have been recorded in 1965 as easily as 1988 or any time in between. Good Man Monologue, a song that sounds to me like an instant pop classic, is no fluke. 5 years ago, Womack and Womack recorded an equally good album called Love Wars, about many of these same themes. They put out a few uneven but worthwhile albums between then and now. The records have sold well in England and throughout Europe, but there's no place for the Womacks on American radio these days. The music, with its mixture of acoustic guitars, electric keyboards, and gritty vocals, doesn't fit into any established genre other than the misleading soul music label that makes the Womacks sound like the sort of old-fashioned revivalist act that they definitely are not. The music of Womack and Womack can be boiled down to one line from the song Good Man Monologue. We're gonna suffer through this thing till we get a better thing for two, babe. It's a great, deceptively casual way of stating the sort of dead serious commitment that not many people, nor much pop music, is willing to risk these days.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
It was 12 o'clock in the midnight hour.
This is Fresh Air. Tony Hillerman's mystery novels evoke a deep sense of place and people. The place is the American Southwest, and the people are the Navajo. Hillerman's following outside the Southwest has grown since the publication in 1986 of his novel Skinwalkers. That novel brought together the heroes of his new book, A Thief of Time, two Navajo tribal policemen, Lieutenant Joe Leaphorn and Officer Jim Chi. When we spoke, I asked Hillerman to describe his main characters.
I think of Leaphorn as a fellow in his late 50s, sort of skinny, sort of what we call a Tuba City type Navajo, a western side of the reservation, cynical fellow, a well-read. In this book, he is consumed with grief, kind of guy that I would like myself.
Okay. Now, he is working nowadays in your novels with a younger police officer, a younger Navajo police officer named Jim Chi. And Jim Chi is much more of a believer than Joe Leaphorn is.
I think of Chi as a more romantic fellow, far more traditional. Incidentally, this is not unusual on the reservation to find your younger people more traditional than your older ones, and also speaking the language better. Chi is a kind of guy that would get on my nerves, as he gets on Leaphorn's nerves.
Now, part of the story is that these two officers are searching for a missing anthropologist. It's interesting to have anthropology as the backdrop for your novel, because I think for the Navajo, it's a sacrilege to dig up bones and to disinter the past.
Well, yeah, it's not something the average Navajo is going to do much of. They have an attitude grown out of very practical reasons that corpses are something to be avoided. And you get around corpses, you get sick. And the Navajos carry it one step further into the metaphysics, and being around corpses too much gets you sick psychologically, see? In other words, ghost sickness translated into more Freudian language.
What is ghost sickness?
Ghost sickness is the kind of sickness that one gets if one is infected by a chindi, the emanation left behind by the death of a person. In the Navajo tradition, in the old beliefs, when one dies, all that remains is all of that person that was not in harmony. In other words, the good disappears, the evil lingers on.
You're not Native American yourself. How did you get to know so much about the traditions and the attitudes of Native Americans?
Two things. I got an early start by being born and raised around Potawatomi and Seminole Indians, going to an Indian school for girls, oddly enough. And then long-standing interest in religion and in the kind of people to whom metaphysical beliefs are important enough so they affect the way they live.
Now, how did you start writing about the Navajo?
Well, I started in I'd done a little bit of nonfiction, you know, magazine stuff, not much and not important, but I wanted to be an author, you know, have people pay attention to me and go on book tours.
All now you good... learned the hard way.
Yeah, and so I thought, well, I'm going to eventually write to, you know, War and Peace in Potawatomi County, but first I'm going to do something easier, and I'd been reading Graham Greene and Eric Ambler and Raymond Chandler, and I've been aware of what certain mystery writers can do with the mystery form, and I thought I'll do one of those, and since I don't know whether I can plot or not, I'll lean on my strength, which is description, and I will run this story against the backdrop of the Navajo people and the Navajo reservation, in whom I thought everybody must be fascinated. I was a little bit wrong about that, but that's how I got started.
It seems to me by having a Navajo main character in your novels, you ran the risk of having Native Americans say, who's this white guy? Well, what does he know? Who's he to be writing about Native Americans?
I was very conscious of it, very uneasy about it. And when I went to book signings around the reservation, I'd have Navajos show up, and at first they'd say, hey, I thought you were a Navajo, you know, which was a high compliment. I don't worry about it now. I gradually dawned on me that the average Navajo is like the average Rotarian. He you know, he doesn't know much about his religion. By now, I've learned frankly, a heck of a lot about that side of it, and in other ways, I've never bought the idea that there's any racial differences between people. Differences are cultural.
You said earlier that one of the things that interested you in the Navajo was finding a group of people for whom metaphysical beliefs was important to how they lived. Now, what religion were you born into?
I was born a Roman Catholic in a little tiny little place, Sacred Heart, Oklahoma, where we were surrounded by a vast ocean of fundamentalists and were looked upon as sort of, you know, sort of like a nine hair Krishnas in the middle of of Ethiopia, or, you know, we were, people came and looked at us, and so, you know, I'm still religion has always been important to me and always will be.
So you're practicing?
Yeah, sure enough.
Does your religion offer to you the same kind of meaning and larger context that you see it offering to the Navajo? You know, the thing that drew you to them in the first place.
Yeah, in a way, it's different, of course, because being a Christian, I the goal is life after death. The Navajo, who has at best a nebulous notion of life after death, has a religion which is aimed purely focused on keeping one in harmony in the present life. Their religion is a system of curing ceremonials, which they were taught by the holy people, which should bring you back into harmony if you get out of harmony. And because of that, they have, no value attached to revenge, because if somebody does something nasty to you, he was out of harmony, and he should be cured, not punished.
Do you ever wish that you were Navajo?
Oh, not really. I never even thought about it. I don't see the As I said, I've never been conscious of racial differences. Having been grown up with, Potts and Seminoles and Blackfeet, I mean, hell, we were country boys. See, we were the Potts and the Seminoles and I. We got on a school bus and carried our lunch in a sack and didn't have any money and wore bib overalls. And the other, there was us and them. I was us. I mean, us were the Indians and I and my brother. The them were the town boys, the kids who wore, you know, belt pants and low-cut shoes and had money and knew how to shoot pool and knew how to use telephones. You know, the sophisticated folks.
I think some writers who grow up poor, when they start writing, want to kind of compensate for that and end up writing things that aren't in their voice at all, but that sound like it should be in the voice of great literature. A lot of writers have told me that, and I wonder if you went through anything like that before you felt comfortable about writing in your own voice.
I had no pretensions of being the Anatole France of of Western America. I just simply, I knew what I could do. I knew I could write clearly. I knew I was good at description. I knew I could move a narrative along. I didn't know if I could develop a character. I didn't know if I could plot. I simply wanted to tell a story. I grew up in a society where my Sacred Heart, Oklahoma, had a cotton gin and a crossed two dirt roads crossed there, and there was a store there, a filling station, and sold everything from, as I said, overalls to nails to pig feed to groceries. And people come sit on a porch, and as a little boy, I'd sit there, and you learn that telling stories is valuable, you know, that people respected people who told stories.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tony Hillerman spoke to us from NPR station KQED in San Francisco. His new mystery novel, A Thief of Time, is published by Harper & Row. This is Fresh Air. Let's take a look ahead and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne is joining us from NPR's Washington studios. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you leading with?
Well, the downing of the Iran air flight is still our top news story, and we'll have an update on that. Also, the Pentagon said today that it is extremely unlikely that a second Iranian airplane was near the passenger jet that was shot down last Sunday. Also, on Long Island, infectious hospital waste have washed up on the beaches there, causing 15 miles of beaches to close, and we'll have a report on that. The Soviets launched a mission to Mars today, and we talked to the world's foremost proponent of the theory that 500,000 years ago, extraterrestrials landed on Mars and built a mile-long human face as a message to Earthlings.
Well, thanks, Renee. Those are some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A World Apart is a new movie about a white family in South Africa involved in the struggle against apartheid. It's set in 1963, and it's based on a true story. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Movies about white anti-apartheid activists in South Africa have a built-in problem. However dramatic the suffering of liberal whites there may be, it seems beside the point compared with the suffering of the blacks they support. Fortunately, white heroism is not what A World Apart is about. The movie's screenwriter, Sean Slovo, is indeed the daughter of South African activists. Her father, Joe Slovo, is the only white member of the Executive Committee of the African National Congress. And her mother was Ruth First, a journalist and activist who was killed in exile by a parcel bomb in 1982. To the degree that the movie is about their struggle, A World Apart is rather ordinary. But mostly it's about something else. About the choices people make between their public commitments and their private lives. And in this case, about the choice that Sean Slovo's mother made between the anti-apartheid cause that needed her and the family that needed her more. On screen, Sean Slovo calls herself Molly Roth, and she's played by an extraordinary 13-year-old named Jodie May, who never tumbles into the child actress traps of excessive cuteness or precocious dignity. Her father has left the country, under very hush-hush circumstances, and her proud, beautiful mother, Diana, seems distant and even hard to her daughter. Diana's political activities are always kept secret from young Molly. And though Molly understands why they have to be, she still feels left out and hurt. And then horrified, as her mother is arrested under a new law which decrees that anyone in South Africa can be held without charges for 90 days.
You're not going to take the address book. You can't take that. It's got the telephone numbers of our doctor, our dentist, all the children's friends.
There are names and numbers of banned people in there, Mrs. Rupp.
For God's sake, I'm a journalist.
Go and pack your suitcase, Mrs. Rupp.
Come on, help me. Jude, don't forget to remind Gran about the orthodontist this week. Molly, you must ask the Abelsons to collect you for writing.
No books except the Bible. No writing paper, no papers.
The tone of that sequence captures the movie's power. Slovo and the director, Chris Menges, realize they don't have to pound the evils of apartheid into our heads. They can concentrate on the intimate drama of a family's breakdown, and the tide of that drama will carry the film's political concerns along with it. Chris Menges, who has long been one of our finest cinematographers, has never directed a feature before, but his hand is absolutely sure. And for the first half of the movie, his camera seems to be inside young Molly's head, discovering her and the world around her at the same time. But as good as A World Apart is, something in it goes wrong when Diana is arrested. The film strays to take in Diana's point of view, and yet, as Barbara Hershey plays her, Diana is impenetrable. So consistently strong and sure and free of doubt that she seems almost inhuman. Perhaps that's the way Molly sees her, but that can't be the way we see her. We need to know more. Does she never waver in her courage, even when she realizes that that courage is destroying her family? When Diana attempts suicide, Hershey and Menges make even this most desperate of acts seem cool and precisely calculated, a political stratagem. That's a big flaw, and there are others. But in the end, they matter very little. The intelligence A World Apart exhibits is rare enough in any political film. This is the first time we've seen it in a film about the intransigent misery of South Africa.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll talk with independent filmmaker Robert Muggy. His music films on Sonny Rollins, Al Green, Ruben Blades, and others are being showcased this summer on public television. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone will review a retrospective of the late photographer Gary Winogrand, now on exhibit at New York's Museum of Modern Art. And singer Susanna McCorkle will pay tribute to Cole Porter. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to hear from you. Write us if you have a minute. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton, who directed today's show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.